Hello and welcome to Sci-Fi.
Sci-Fi?
Sci-Fi.
Sci-Fi, 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 a podcast whose name may change in the near future.
It's continually evolving.
Maybe not.
Or maybe not. Anyway, I'm Steven, joined as ever by Kevin and Barry. I'll sometime figure out which one is which. And today we are talking about Stories of Your Life and Others by Ted Chiang. Who chose this one?
I did.
Would you grace us with a reading of the back of the book, please?
I will grace you with a partial reading of the back of the book.
Even more graceful.
Suddenly I had this mental image of all of us in tutus. All right. This new edition of Ted Chiang's masterful first collection, Stories of Your Life and Others, includes his first 8 published stories, combining the precision and scientific curiosity of Kim Stanley Robinson with Laurie Moore's cool, clear love of language and narrative intricacy. This award-winning collection offers listeners the dual delights of the very, very strange and the heartbreakingly familiar.
All right. Well, what did everybody think?
Positive.
Great. Thank you, bit. Yes.
Is that Captain Pike?
Beep, beep. No, I was thinking of the bit from Tron.
Yes, I know.
Anyway, Barry, what did you think?
I really liked it.
Yes, so did I. For me, it sort of reminded me of Jorge Luis Borges, which I think I must have convinced myself that I get a dime every time I get a Jorge Luis Borges mention.
Here's a dime.
Thank you. The thing that I really found interesting about it is there's a lot of kind of formal problem solving. He starts on an idea and he just focuses on that idea to the exclusion of everything else and sort of beats everything else to death. And that's what the stories are really about. They're about the ideas. There's some interesting character development, but that's not necessarily what the story is about. The story is about the idea. And it gives sort of a spareness to it that I found really interesting. However, I think that there could definitely be people that would not like this kind of story, that would say, okay, well, yeah, it was just about this idea. Could I have, you know, an actual plot in here?
Well, but I think there was a, you know, very laser-like focus on what he was starting with and where he wanted to go.
Exactly.
I mean, it was very A to B. There was no meandering.
Well, I did really like the science and the math and stuff that was in there. You know, it wasn't necessarily like, oh, this is a formal proof of something. It was just like, oh, this had an interesting scientific method sometimes. And,
right.
And sometimes it was, like you said, it was about a concept. So it was like, you know, here's about this mathematical idea. But even like they mentioned at the very beginning of the division by zero one, that proof that, you know, I remember that as a kid, you know, which I thought was always thought was cool.
Yeah. His are very classic kinds of science fiction stories, which often involve, well, what if? But in this case, the what ifs can be very abstract, such as, well, what if math was wrong and we could prove it?
Right. And so I really liked the concepts, and some of the stories were like, I liked the stories overall, but then like at towards the end, it kind of got a little bit too much for me, but I still liked it because of the concept.
Yeah, exactly.
Are you referring to Hell is the Absence of God?
Well, that was one that I was just like, wow, that's,
I thought that was one,
I think
that
not was, awesome.
I thought that was one of my favorites.
Well, yeah, there was,
the resolution was not happy feely.
That was one where I wasn't entirely sure if my take on it, which was sort of gleeful sense of humor, was the same as Ted Chiang's take on it, which may have been sort of, and this is what would happen.
Right. I mean, actually, I was thinking of Understand, where I really liked the story, but towards the end, it kind of got a little bit too much, you know, where he has the magic. He's given the medication that makes him smart, basically. But
yeah, I mean, that one kind of reminded me a bit of Lucy.
Yeah, it's the absolute, yes. You know, Lucy is the, yes, the dumbest possible description of that.
Right. Yeah.
Understand is the smartest possible description of what if somebody had Lucy. Infinite intelligence.
I do remember watching Lucy and not enjoying where it ended up. But
yeah, I mean, I really liked, you know, because at first I thought, oh, this is going to be like Neal Stephenson, where, you know, Neal Stephenson does a lot of, you know, kind of science and computer related things. Like, you know, he has kind of like an assumption that you maybe understand some stuff, or at least will appreciate discussions of binary, right, or something like that. This one doesn't make that assumption, but it does have a lot of stuff where they describe math and you describe science things. So I kind of appreciated that it went to that level of detail with some of that part.
Right. There's a certain assumption that readers are geniuses, which is...
obviously accurate.
For obviously us. Accurate.
I don't get it.
Yeah.
On average, it's accurate.
Okay. Well, until our intelligence expands, until we all have mind powers and then engage into a battle of the death.
We force choked each other.
I think it's time for us to take a break and... come back for our discussion section, where we will discuss people discussing things about other things. And until then, we are Sci-Fi.
Sci-Fi?
Chucky.
He's dividing sci-fi. By zero.
All right, and welcome back to Sci-Fi, Sci-Fi, Sci-Fi.
Thank you.
So this is our spoiler section, where we will discuss spoilers about the book until basic mathematical facts are proved false.
They are false, but I guess we could try to prove it.
Is it like the three-body problem?
Don't start, Barry.
All right, so since this is a series of novellas rather than a cohesive novel, we're going to go through book by book, as they say. So we're going to start out with Tower of Babylon, which for me was... a really interesting story, but I kind of had trouble with the end. I didn't sort of understand, but could one of you give sort of a basic description of what was going on in it?
Well, the word stopped at the end.
I didn't get the ending either. Yes. I listened to it probably three or four times and couldn't quite visualize what happened.
Well, they dug up into the sky.
Right. So this is a story about...
a tower.
Yes.
The Tower of Babylon.
The building of the Tower of Babel and...
Right. And so he said this was inspired by like earlier versions of the story, I guess, mm-hmm. where the tower is so tall that it takes an entire year to climb to the top.
Right.
So he kind of thinks the audacity of that scale sort of, you know, was interesting. And so, right, they're basically using ancient, you know, techniques and, you know, they were talking about getting Egyptian stonemasons to come because the story enters when the tower already exists and it's already made its way up to the tower or up to the Dome of Heaven.
Right.
So one of the diggers is, you know, basically entering the world of the tower. They climb up it, you know, over the course of, I guess it is a whole year or something like that, where they, you know, they cart materials up and they cart all their digging tools. And there's like a caravans that constantly go up and down, you know, supplying people that live on the tower.
Right.
And there's little farms along the way. And
yeah. There's basically entire like villages and stuff that live right, up and down this giant tower.
Entire vertical civilization. All right. And this has sort of been described as science fiction for a completely different worldview, taking the Babylonian worldview more seriously and doing a what if this particular worldview were absolutely correct.
Oh, right. I mean, it actually reminded me of space elevators. And there's a story I'd read a couple years ago about one. And so it was basically like the Babylonian space elevator.
Right.
And they had the same type of thing where it was like, well, okay, what if we had, you know, something that would actually go all the way out into space and then it was so huge that basically people would be living on it. You'd have like entire economies of stuff. And then, you know, people actually live in there full time and then you'd rent out things. And so it had a similar kind of feel to this, except just with like, it was stone technology instead of
more donkeys and carts
like
than
stone punk or something.
Stone punk. It's almost more clay punk.
I mean, clay punk. So, well, he does do another clay punk story later, but
yes.
So basically they get up to the dome. And they have this whole ingenious thing of, well, it rains out of the Dome of Heaven. And so, but they couldn't find any openings in it. So they said, well, just to be safe, we have this whole ingenious plan of doing the kind of like a zigzag tunneling with these like stops.
So their whole plan is to basically mine the Dome of Heaven, which is, you know, the sky is made of rock.
Right. Once they get up to the dome, it's like in Minecraft where you just can't go any higher or something. Right. And so...
Yeah, they did have that series of water locks, basically, in case there was like a giant flood.
And so they said, well, there must be reservoirs of water in heaven where the rain comes from. So if we happen to dig into one, you know, we might be screwed. So they have these locks that they could manually or it'll automatically, if the water comes down, it'll push one and like block it. So it won't just like kill everyone in the tower and like rain forever.
Okay.
So
but what happens at the end?
So basically they hit pay dirt and like water starts coming out.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, sort of our main character that we started with is like, oh crap, we're all going to die. And so he's like quickly trying to run down, and he and three or four of the other diggers run down, and they've already sealed it.
Right.
And so they're like, oh crap, there's no possible way you can get out. And so I think they end up dying, you know, and he's like, okay, I might as well just try to swim up to heaven, because, you know, what else am I going to do?
Right. Well, basically, he realizes that the water's rising. So he's like, well, I'll just go with it.
And, yeah.
Right. So, you know, basically get back out.
He basically gets up, holds his breath right at the last second, and then just like swims through the opening. And he's swimming and swimming. And he finally kind of like, you know, sees, oh, you know, I'm seeing the light kind of coming up, and he breaks the surface. And he comes out and he's like, okay, I'm in heaven. You know, this is awesome and weird. And so he's like walking around in a desert thinking, is heaven just like Earth? And then he meets some guy, and the guy's like, hey, what's up? And he's like, where are you from? And he's like, oh, you know, from such and such. And he's like, oh, from where are you? Is this heaven or whatever? And the guy's just like, no. And so, I mean, basically what happens
is... No, Iowa. It's actually a big prequel to Field of Dreams.
Right. So basically what happens is he figures out that, you know, the Earth has been convoluted in some way, you know, the universe of humans, such that when you dig through heaven, you're actually somehow digging through under the Earth.
And that, my lead, and is it, how we know the Earth to be banana shaped.
Right. And so you come out, and so he happened to come out into a lake on the Earth. And so, you know, his, you know, the Tower of Babylon was like, you know, some leagues away somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's like, okay, I guess you've come back around to the Earth. So that's why God wasn't pissed that we were trying to dig into heaven, because he knew we could never get there. It's like, the, you know, there's some like, you know, four-dimensional
They did have that sort of lengthy discussion about, you know, is God going to be angry that we're going to break into heaven, essentially?
Right. And some people are like, of course not. He would have destroyed it earlier. And other people are like, well, you know, you don't really know.
Yeah. That one avenue of thought was, yes, he would have stopped us before we got this far. And
right. And they talk about, like, you know, years ago, a star actually hit the tower, and they, you know, they waited for it to cool down and, you know, used it to make something or whatever. I forget.
Yeah, they did use the metal to do something.
Yeah. Okay. And I actually, so this actually reminds me, like I said, of the space elevator thing. And it actually, I kind of thought of it more of like that than anything else. So it was kind of like the concept of, you know, having people living on the tower permanently. And they were saying, once you get to a certain point, you're actually like at the elevation of the sun and, or above it. And so it's like, now the light's coming from below you, and you had to like have your plants leaning out and growing upside down and stuff. And it's kind of just interesting.
Yeah. Okay. So then next we had Understand, which is about a man of normal intelligence who gets a drug that vastly increases his intelligence. And this is a standard kind of story, but usually what happens is it's someone of subnormal intelligence that, you know, gets this super intelligence drug, and there's some tremendous side effect that, you know, turns out to be massively terrible, and eventually crashes and dies.
Flowers for Algernon is the obvious one.
Or Algernon, we can't decide.
Yes, one of the two.
I've decided.
That's great, but you won't be revealing which one.
Why would I spoil it?
I know. This was actually, I think, my favorite novella. It's kind of the most intellectual possible comic book that one could possibly ever write, because we have an intellectual superhero who just is smarter than anybody ever could possibly be.
Except for the other guy.
Yes, exactly. He's worried that the police are going to track him, and so he does this sort of basic level hack that will sort of make them think, oh, okay, we've discovered what he's done, and yeah, he's obviously smart, but he's not nearly as smart as he thinks he is, and that actually disguised the real virus that he had planted in things.
Right. So, yeah, the idea was that this drug kind of adds another meta level to your intelligence, so it's like suddenly everything that was difficult is sort of trivial, and you can see, like, you know, another layer of complexity on top of that, and all the connections. And then, you know, at one point they're like, well, hey, we want to do more experiments. Do you want another dose? He's like, okay. And like, and he's just thinking, this is going to be awesome. I'm going to even have another, you know, cause like, I could sense that there's this other level that I'm almost at, but not quite. And
right. And it's really the descriptions of the meta concepts that he's getting. He can't really describe them in human level language, but Ted Chiang is amazing at hinting at the amazing insights that this guy is getting. his whole focus is he wants more insights. He doesn't particularly want to take over the world. He doesn't care.
Right. He ends up like reprogramming himself essentially from almost like outside his own consciousness.
Right.
Which was, I thought was really interesting.
Yes. But he did do a lot of metaprogramming on himself, like you were saying. And, right. And like, I liked at one point where he was like, oh, I'm designing this new super language to describe stuff. And in fact, this is like a recurring theme in the other Arrival story, which would, you know, a different name, but, you know,
story of your life.
Yes. The story of your life, but, you know, where it's like a super language that can.
And there's also a recurring theme of being intellectually isolated, just being so much smarter than the people around you, or having such a different point of view than the people around you, that
it is a burden.
I can totally sympathize.
Each of us thinking, I'm the only conscious person in this room.
Well, we all know that the world is one of our dreams. We just don't know which one.
And I'm in control of them all.
Uh-huh. At one point, I started thinking of the ending of this, where he actually intuits the existence of somebody that actually got the treatment before he did, and so is ahead of him by something like a whole 2 days or something like that.
Yeah, some small number of hours.
But when it's exponential, it's a lot.
Exactly. And somebody who is the only other person that can appreciate the stuff that he's done and the thoughts that he's had, but at the same time just has a different outlook and wants to do a different thing. This is somebody who ironically wants to bring peace to the earth. And
right, but also seems like equally paranoid.
Exactly.
Well, right, because he's like out for himself and he wants to make this, you know, cybernetic interface to the brain so that
our original character.
Yeah, the original character wants to do that.
Or Greco, I think.
I don't remember, but his thing is, you know, he's not there for world peace. He's just like, oh, well, I'm going to do this stuff and it's going to be awesome. And, right. You know, if there's fallouts because I made this entire new industry, then, you know, I guess that's just what's going to happen. And the other guy's like, oh, no, you know, his conclusion was, you know, you got to kind of fix the world and make world peace and do awesome stuff. And they both realize they're diametrically opposed views that'll conflict. So they all kind of, you know, they instantly know, okay, it's a battle of the wills. And
right. And the interesting thing is, being really smart does not give either of them superpowers. They have this battle at the end, which is essentially like the two of them sort of staring at each other and occasionally changing facial expression.
I mean, they do have sort of superpowers, but meaning like he's able to reprogram the other guy's brain to, like, you know, do something, you know, using his brain somehow.
Yeah, but you get the impression that he's just sort of like moving slightly, or I mean, it's hard,
right,
to know.
It would be not very cinematic.
Right. I was sort of thinking
about,
it would
be like comedy cinematic where they would like zoom in on the guy's eye and he would twitch his eyebrow or something.
Yeah, exactly. I was thinking of, it's kind of like a comic book battle because we have these two giants that are duking it out. But if you actually showed what was actually happening, it would just be these panels of these guys sort of going,
staring at each other and right. Basically things vibrating subtly. And
yeah, and then like occasionally one guy changing facial expression very subtly.
Well, the one thing I thought was funny and kind of on the lead up to that was where the guy who was a little bit ahead of him wanted to alert him, but subtly alert him, I guess, because I was like, well, he could have just, like, you know, dropped by and said, hey, what's up? I'm super smart too.
Right.
Let's duke it out or whatever.
Left a post-it note.
But yeah, instead he does this totally convoluted thing, which I could totally appreciate in this bizarre way where he's like, okay, we manipulated the stock market and all these industries just so that when their stocks change just a little bit, it would, if you took the first letter of each one, it would spell out boo or whatever it was.
Spelled out, you know, I think the guy's name or
yeah,
something.
It was something.
Greco.
Oh yeah. Yeah. So it was something that was just like, I can appreciate how like convoluted that was, and it was sort of an awesome.
The only reason idea. He, you know, he's like, the only reason he would have noticed is because he actually lost money on his financial investment.
Yeah, yeah. He's like, huh? That's not possible.
Yeah. So he goes back and like does, you know, a bunch of rechecking and realizes, you know, it's basically someone trying to, you know, send like a Morse code signal to say, hey, I'm out here.
Right.
Right.
And so for me, I thought that this was, from a plot perspective, this was a comic book, which I enjoyed. But the real winner for me was he was so good at describing the kinds of insights that someone super intelligent might have to people of, you know, ordinary intelligence.
Yeah, I say that I really like this story, except towards the end, it got a little bit too much for me somehow. And maybe it was just too comic booky or something. But
right. I really liked the ending.
But
I liked it, too. I mean, it was you know, he sort of realizes at the very end that he's basically been outsmarted by just a couple of steps, right?
And right.
He's like, oh crap. And, or, you know, I made like
the little girl whistling actually was the trigger for the trap that I was walking up to the building and I didn't even realize it. God damn it.
Right. That, you know, he's thinking, okay, the guy suggests that, I can destroy your brain with the magic word. Basically it's like power word kill or whatever. Like in D&D.
And once that happened, I'm just like, oh, this is one of those things where one person says to the other, I have a secret plan. And part of the plan is that the other person figures out what the plan is. And I'm just like, no, just stop thinking.
Well, the best part was is that he basically, it was that, but he's like, it was like a fake out plan, right?
Exactly.
It was a meta plan where he's like, okay, I'll make this special brain simulator in my brain that will analyze all of my sensory input and look at it to make sure that it's not going to kill me. And then that simulator is what was the key component to killing him, basically.
Right, exactly.
Like, and he's like, damn it. You know, and then he just kind of, he like twitches and falls over.
Got your brain.
So it does end.
I've
like
got your brain. Like, oh, that doesn't work without my hand gesture.
Yes.
All right. Okay. Moving on to Division by Zero. So if you like your stories abstract, this is about as abstract as it gets.
It's like, yep. There's a lot of suicide attempts and abstract math and a lot of depressed people.
1 + 1 does not equal 2.
Right.
Yes. Although that's an awesome proof that I think it was the first proof that I was ever exposed to as a kid.
Explains so much.
It's a proof that what?
It starts out A equals A and A equals B.
I'm going to ask you to summarize.
Well, then it goes. Okay. No, I could probably write it out, but I won't. Basically, it's through a series of algebraic manipulations. You prove that A equals 2A at the end. And when at the very beginning, it's A equals A.
Right.
And so you're like, what the hell? And, you know, all these algebraic steps make sense. And the trick is, there's an A minus B in the middle that you divide by, which is dividing by zero. So symbolically, it makes sense, but you have to realize, oh, I'm dividing by zero, so that invalidates the whole proof. And right. that was the title of the story, Division by Zero. You know, that, and he mentions that proof in there as kind of the, well, what if this was actually the case and not just like, you know, a trick like this one proof is.
Exactly. And what we really have is a mathematician who becomes isolated because she was one of the few people that feels math on an emotional level. And so if you showed me that, say, oh, all math is wrong, I would probably say,
you're insane.
I would be like, well, whatever. That's too bad.
I know. You're like, it's still a useful tool.
Right. Exactly.
She's just like, what do you mean? You know, now it's all meaningless.
Right. And, you know, her very supportive boyfriend, fiance, whatever, is trying to understand what's going through her mind. And only a few people in the mathematical world can possibly be bothered by this. And
right. I mean, like, basically she has like her coworkers or, you know, people who are working in the, is she in an academic setting? I can't remember, but she has like a bunch of, you know, people around her in the same department.
Right. And she's
look at the proof and they're like,
yep, looks good.
It looks fine to me.
Right. I mean, it's basically like the, you know, she's like Einstein in there and she's working with a bunch of monkeys or something like that by comparison to how smart she is. And she's like, don't you understand? Like, you know, and she's just like going nuts. And she's like, here, maybe you could find something that's wrong with my proof. And they're like,
please find something wrong.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing is, it's not just that she's smarter than they are, because they can understand the proof just fine. They're just like, oh, yeah, that's really brilliant work.
Yeah, they're looking just looking past like the implication of it.
Right. And I think they, like you said, they can logically understand like, oh, this would technically invalidate everything, but they kind of, you know, kind of just sweep it on the rug and go, okay, well, I can continue with my work and just sort of ignore that weird oddity. And
right. And that, you know, kind of applies to Gödel's theorem is my vague understanding.
Yeah. There's a lot of stuff where they talk about, you know, Gödel's incompleteness and they talk about other things and they basically say like, oh, like you can't, there's no proof that shows that geometry is self-consistent or something. But there is a proof that says it's consistent if arithmetic is consistent, but no one's been able to prove that. And they talk about the Principia Mathematica, which, going back into insanities of my childhood, there's probably my favorite documentary is a Nova documentary called Mathematical Mystery Tour, which you could probably find online. And it's basically an hour of people doing math proofs.
Barry is looking at us as though as though he is trapped in a room with madmen.
He can't get you guys out of my house.
Yes, we...
I'm trapped in here with them. They're not trapped here with me.
So yes, if you kind of like math, go find it online and watch it because it's really awesome. But anyway, it was one of those, you know, an early introduction I had to sort of, you know, I can't say I understand math on that level or anywhere near that level, but I enjoy reading about it, I guess, you know, and so there's a lot of things like that where there's a lot of famous proofs that nobody has been able to do. And there's a lot of math that's kind of, it's all self-consistent, but they can't really prove that the whole system is consistent.
Right.
So most people kind of, you know, don't even think about it or care. And a lot of people view it like, I get the understanding that, like, you know, physicists, it's like, well, you can view it as a tool, but it doesn't have to be, you know, because you can prove that you can use math to predict things. So, you know, that's fine. But pure mathematics, you know, it's like, eh.
Okay. Moving on. Story of your life. That, of course, was recently made into the movie Arrival.
This was the reason I selected this book.
Exactly. Yes. And Arrival is a relatively faithful adaptation of it with a couple of major changes. The biggest one being, if you made an absolutely straight adaptation of Story of Your Life, you would not get any idea of predestination whatsoever. Because part of the idea of predestination is that our main character cannot ever say anything about predestination because she herself is, her every move is predestined and she is predestined to act like she has free will.
Yeah, they kind of say, you know, it seemed like they were in some, you know, there was somebody else that also kind of had the predestination power.
Well, there was another linguist.
Right, but I thought I got the impression that they also had the same predestination glimpse into the future.
They had, so there was a conversation between two linguists that had both been studying the language, and she described it as an elaborate stage play.
Right, where they were like spies, and they like, nobody ever, you know, breaks cover or whatever, but they both play their lines perfectly. And
was this language B or language A? I think it was language B, right?
Well, they were talking in English. You don't talk in an alien language to a colleague of yours, generally.
Why not?
Indeed, Stephen.
Yes. You can think that.
Well, yeah, because a lot of it, so, you know, they kind of, you know, one major thing was, you know, free will versus determinism. Like you say, like, if you know it's going to happen and something bad happens, why don't you change it? And they kind of say, well, the way it was described in the story was, well, you know what's going to happen, but it's like you're in a play all the time.
Right.
You know, you're actualizing it, what happens by making it happen. So but you're not changing what's happening. You're just like playing a perfect version of the play.
Well, it's like, you know, in the gaming industry, right? It's like basically you're on the rails, right? This is the only place the train can go.
Now, when I was reading this, I thought I was being really clever because I thought, oh, yeah, this is just like Slaughterhouse-Five by Kurt Vonnegut. And when I was listening to the afterword, he said, oh, yeah, I got this idea from Slaughterhouse-Five by Kurt Vonnegut. And I have mixed feelings about that because, okay, I guess I'm happy that I was right. But on the other hand, I don't feel very creative about it, which I guess sort of ties into the theme of the story as well.
But did you get that feeling from the movie itself?
So the difference is that in the movie, she actually can use the fact that she has foreknowledge of events by doing things like, you know, knowing things that she couldn't possibly know and right. Then acting on that knowledge. And then her husband is angry with her because she admits that she had foreknowledge that her daughter was going to die.
Right. And I think they also changed the fact that she dies, you know, at a much younger age in the movie versus
right.
in the book. She, you know, she becomes an adult and...
Well, also, didn't she die from, like, falling off of, you know,
right.
a cliff yeah. or something?
A far more preventable thing. And so that would actually be a lot harder to get across in the movie.
Right. And they do discuss like, oh, you know, they made it some, you know, they called into question like whether it was predestined completely, like it was predestined, but also she said maybe my protective, because I knew she was going to die, I was always protecting her from climbing. And that actually kind of made her grow into someone who always wanted to climb because I was always trying to make her stop climbing.
Right. You know, there was always a tension between her feelings of, I know exactly what's going to happen, and her feeling that she can't change anything.
Right. And they do use the thing like, I remember when you will do this. And right. so I can't experience what it would be like reading this because I saw the movie ahead of time. Yeah, I had a hard time.
Or maybe it's the perfect understanding.
well, like, you know, I don't know when I would have figured out, because it took a while in the movie where you're like, oh, it's not just a weird structure. She's actually gained this ability partway through the movie to see into the future. And it's not flashbacks, it's flash forwards.
Right. The movie was deliberately ambiguous, and I think it was very strong for that.
Yes. And the book use wording, you know, I will remember when, but you easily kind of filter that out when you're listening and just think it was just the way it was written, not that it's explicitly trying to say, oh, this is something that I remember from the future, you know. Yes.
Well, anyway, time to move on to 72 Letters, possibly one of the more disturbing stories in here. Somebody else want to talk about this?
Megafetus?
Yes, Kevin would like to describe the megafetus.
I don't think that's actually accurate. But I did like the story. The more I like the concept of, it was sort of like clay punk, whatever you wanted to call it, the Victorian steampunk, but it wasn't steam at all. It was like all of their technology was based on, you know, the idea of the golem, where you can construct things and using a name. I don't know if all of them were 72 letters in Hebrew or not, but it's like programming, right? You know, right. You could find this sequence of letters that gives a human shaped thing animation, and it could do certain basic tasks.
So it's almost like a DNA type thing, but
right,
more complex.
Yeah, right. It's sort of a bridging the gap between sort of computer code and DNA.
And then they also go into a lot of arguments or discussions about, should we allow, you know, like poor people to, you know, self-create their own creations and that sort of thing. It's kind of...
Right. So in this story, we're back in, like you said, in Victorian England. But the stories of the golems are true. You can animate anything. You can animate clay, specifically with 72 letters. And
but there's also it's also limited to a very select subset of people that can do right. This.
Well, they do have a lot of like IP discussions, basically, of like, oh, you know, these ones have been in the public domain. You know, just Porter code to have golems that can carry your baggage around, that's been in the public domain for a while. But, you know, the IP is a major industry, and they... And so obviously that's kind of mirroring stuff now.
Monsanto, GMO foods, that sort of thing.
Any kind of code.
I mean, even if you want to go back to sort of like the Industrial Revolution, right? The ability for people to, you know, purchase a machine to make other things.
Right. And so there was a big component of social justice and social change, where he's talking about the weavers who, you know, now it's all done in a factory and these people are working for nothing and machines, you know, do a lot of stuff. And he wants to kind of reclaim that by making golems cheap enough for people to buy them in their homes.
Right. And there's people who are against them, people who want to, you know, work with him, but for their own means and that type of thing. And
so, right. The main guy, he comes up with a golem that actually has full articulating hands. And then the clay working industry flips out because they're like, oh crap, you're going to put us all out of work. And so he's like, we're not even going to help you. So yeah, this thing basically went to the point where they figured out that whatever it was called, the pre-Genesis existed, where within three or four generations, humans are going to stop.
Right. Stop being able to procreate naturally by themselves, you know, plus or minus a couple generations, I think.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so he figures out basically a way around it, you know, and also at the same time screwing his corporate overlords. But, you know, he's willing to do it for the good of the world.
All right. Okay, moving on. The Evolution of Human Science.
Yeah, no, this one was a very short piece, basically, of like, it was published in Science or a science journal.
Right. And it was basically, should we still let humans publish science or do science in any way now that enhanced humans and computers and so forth are much better at it?
Right. They had a series of fiction pieces in the journal, and this was just one that he wrote for it. And it was very short.
Right. Then we have Hell is the Absence of God, which is one of the more colorful pieces.
I thought it was great.
Yeah. This is a world where it would require great effort to be an atheist, because there's...
Angels make continual visits to the planet. And
right. And actually,
interesting things happen.
Right. There's a tremendous problem of angels granting blessings to people, but the side events of those are usually horrifying earthquakes and...
Right. You know, it was sort of like, you know, the... roll effects table. It's like, you know, when you show up, it's like different angels or tornadoes or floods or whatever. But then it's like, you know, there's a number of people around who also get, you know, something taken away from them or maimed, or, and then some of them are just incidental bystanders that happen to be there, and they're killed by shattering glass or, you know, shock waves or whatever. And it's just It was sort of, it was, again, it was like a, given this premise, you know, what, how would the world change? And so,
exactly. Yeah,
it was a good example of that, of his kind of style like that. I did enjoy that part.
I mean, even down to the, you know, as the angel appears, right, the light comes down from the heavens and anybody who happens to be looking in that general direction, you know, has their eyeballs melted away. And
right. But those people are generally considered to be, those people are going to be enlightened and saved.
Right. Because, yeah, they've,
because they have died from the angelic light, and what could be holier than that?
I'm going to go to heaven.
Right. Except for this one guy, who has just had nothing but kind of a living hell this entire time.
Been crapped on from since day one.
And then he finally understands the true glory of God, and he loves God with all of his being. And then he goes to hell, where he continues to love God, even though he is being tormented and God is completely absent.
And even to add to it, right, they have that sort of Mad Max, you know, version at the end where they're basically driving around in the cars trying to catch up to basically angel strikes and, you know, out in somewhere. And
right, because you only see the light of heaven angel as chasers. An angel enters or exits.
Yes. Moving on. Liking What You See, a documentary.
Kind of reminded me of like, it's the same style as World War Z. It's sort of like a series of the book itself, right?
It is told in the sort of standpoint of the script for a documentary.
Yes.
Which couldn't possibly exist, but...
Never.
Well, the script for a documentary shouldn't exist.
Are you going meta on me again?
No, I'm actually trying to express a thing.
Damn it.
Confusing.
I don't understand.
Okay, well, maybe you don't understand when I try to speak normally. It's normal.
That's true.
So the idea there is that there is an ability to deactivate the portions of your brain that make people attractive or unattractive. And the utopia that might result from that, but the fact that...
It's just to bring fairness to the planet.
Exactly. Because they said, well, people have acknowledged racism and sexism and stuff, but nobody acknowledges lookism.
Right. Well, and I'm again reminded of Kurt Vonnegut with Harrison Bergeron, which was a story that he had where, you know, a world where everybody was forced to be average, and if you were pretty, you had to wear a mask, and if you were very graceful, you had to wear weights and that sort of thing.
Haven't read that one.
Mm-hmm. And so one of the interesting things there was that, you know, really beautiful people would be unable to recognize that they were particularly pretty because that portion of the brain had been shut down. You know, I didn't get the impression that Ted Chiang was on one side or the other. The narrator... There were a male and a female narrator, and you got the impression that the female narrator kind of gave, you know, the pretty people slightly stupider voices.
I did not pick up on that, but
I mean,
maybe
granted,
just because I don't know, I'm not that, you know,
she was
ugly,
kind of bringing things down to a teenage level, so I was probably just mostly reading into that. But
well, I mean, the brain surgery that they give them, it's like micro brain surgery to basically turn off your ability to recognize beauty, you know, sort of gets forced on kids at, like, it almost seems like high school almost.
Right.
Well, it was basically, it was a special school that if you want to go attend the school, you have to have that done. And so your parents decide. And then it's basically following the story of someone who grew up with this their whole life or once they hit a certain age.
Right.
And then
had it turned
in
off
college, when they hit 18, they're like, okay, I'm turning this off. And then their reaction to turning it off and that kind of stuff. And
well, I also thought it was interesting because I think they also, you know, later went into this thing where they started manipulating audio, you know, audible language, right, to... Or am I confusing this with something else?
Well, you're talking about they were going to vote on in the students as to whether it should be mandatory in the college to have it on or off, or just it's by your choice. And so, yeah, they had someone right before the election come in and say how bad it would be because you're forcing people to do this. They're not really growing as a person. You're just forcing them to do it. And so, yeah, then later on after the election, it comes out, they have new computer processes to sort of like manipulate someone's speech so that they're like the best orator in the world. And so everyone's like a Martin Luther King or a Winston Churchill. And so like, and they talk about, I mean, it's kind of like now where it's like, you know, you see ads and everyone in the ad is beautiful and they're always, you know,
perfect.
They've always, you know, carefully curated every word. It's like poetry, even though it's not, but you know, they spend a long time to make sure those 10 words are the perfect sequence. And
exactly.
So it's, you know, it was interesting.
Yes, I thought it was Ted Chiang actually withdrew this from consideration for the Hugo Award because he felt that it had not gone where he wanted to go as a story, and he thought that he'd gotten too much publication pressure for it. So he basically said, oh, no, don't give me an award for this one, which it seems like a very Ted Chiang thing to do, not knowing the guy at all. But
I feel like that was something he would do.
Yeah.
I mean, is this his way to sort of like prevent publishers from doing that in the future? You know, because I could imagine it's like, well, you know, yes, this would have been great for your sales, but not anymore.
Yeah. No, I think that he's just trying to only put out his best work. Maybe
his like intellectual purity, which I could appreciate. It's like, well, I don't want to put this out, but no, you have to. He's like, damn it. Like,
look, Kevin, just check in the code already. I don't care if it doesn't work for that one edge case.
It's close enough.
Yes. So we have to answer our usual question. Was there tea? The main character actually sips tea in Story of Your Life, so we know that tea is now predestined.
Damn it.
All right,
currently an angel arriving outside the house. We've got to go.
Okay, yes. Well, with that news report, I think it's time for us to possibly divide into going to heaven and going to hell.
My eyes. I'm just going to prove that 1 = 2.
Exactly. If you're looking for us on iTunes, search for SF3, because if you search for sci-fi, you will probably just get a generic list of science fiction podcasts.
Which we ironically don't appear on.
Yes, exactly. So until next time, we have been sci-fi.
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 Yeah.
Did Hugo's wings flap?